preliminary questions or issues? Okay. I said we'd pick up with the questions on whatever page it is here. Page 32. Just to kind of review the material we've covered here. And let's start with the first one here. How does a finder of fact conclude that there is negligence per se? What does the plaintiff need to show to be entitled to a negligence per se ruling? Yes, sir. Okay. The first thing is a statutory violation. And sometimes that's obvious, as in the buggy case, where it's clear there was no light on the buggy. The statute was violated. In other cases, there will be some dispute. The plaintiff claims the defendant was going above the speed limit, and the defendant says the defendant wasn't traveling above the speed limit. There's conflicting testimony. So whether or not there is a statutory violation may be something that's clear, or it may be something that's up for grabs that itself becomes a jury question. Okay, what else do we need to have before we can get a negligence per se ruling? Yes, sir. Okay, there are two different things that we're talking about here. One, I would actually put third, is the idea that the violation is unexcused. Now, that's actually not part of the plaintiff's burden. It's technically part of the defendant's burden of proof. If the defendant believes an excuse applies such that the doctrine of negligence per se is inapplicable, it's the defendant's burden to come forward with the excuse. But for your purposes of analyzing, how useful would a negligence per se theory be in this particular situation, you should probably, on the plaintiff's behalf, be thinking about that. Is it likely that the defendant would have a plausible excuse to offer? There's another thing we need to show. Bernards? That I would actually consider that to be a different issue. That is, in addition to showing that the doctrine of negligence per se applies, that only takes us so far. We also have to, but even before we get to apply negligence per se, we've got to worry about something else. Mr. Phillips. Right. What it's essentially the statutory purpose issue. And the case to illustrate the importance of this principle is this case in the notes, Gorris versus Scott, note number 4. The plaintiff loses his sheep being transported by the defendant, and it turns out that when the defendant was transporting the plaintiff's sheep, the defendant didn't enclose them in pens on the ship as required by statute. The lack of pens, or if the defendant had abided by the statute, the sheep would not have been lost. When the plaintiff tried to say violation of statute, negligence per se, the court said, not so fast. We need to know the purpose of this statute. Was it designed to prevent injuries like this? Was the statutory requirement enacted so that owners of sheep wouldn't have their cargo swept overboard? No, the purpose of this was a health requirement so that sheep carrying disease would in effect be quarantined, or the spread of disease would be limited. It had nothing to do with the prevention of accidents like this. failing the statutory purpose prong, the doctrine of negligence per se did not apply. Now, how do we know if the statute simply says, thou shalt keep thy sheep penned up, how do we know what its purpose is? Mr. Breck? Sometimes we have this thing called legislative history, and that the whole use of the role of legislative history in the process of statutory interpretation is itself a very complex issue. And there's oftentimes law schools offer a class in statutory interpretation because it's a very complex business and is extremely important when you're arguing cases in court. Oftentimes debatable points about exactly what a statute means and what rules you follow to interpret difficult statutory passages, that's a whole subject in itself. But sometimes from the legislative history we can glean that this was either contemplated or that it was not contemplated by the people who passed the statute. Sometimes the placement of the statute will tell us something. If, for example, the statute says, thou shalt have no billboard closer than 25 feet from the center of the road, does this occur in the Highway Beautification Act, or does it occur in the motor vehicle safety section of the statute? So again, there are different kinds of ways that you can go about trying to determine statutory purpose. But one way or the other, we need to come to the conclusion that the kind of accident that occurred to the plaintiff is within the evils that the statute was designed to prevent. And sometimes this is broken down into that the purpose of the statute was to prevent this particular kind of accident, that is, motor vehicle accidents as distinguished from uglification of the countryside. And another element that's sometimes separated out is, and was the plaintiff within the class intended to be protected? Was this for, you know, if you have some statute about, railroad safety appliances, was this meant to protect only the people who worked on the railroad, or was it designed to prevent injuries to passengers or other people as well? But I've tended to simply use this shorthand to say you need to have you need to spend some time thinking about whether or not the injury that occurred is the kind of thing the statute was designed to prevent. Okay, and then the third one we've already talked about, whether the violation is unexcused. If you meet all three, there was in fact a statutory violation, this is the kind of injury or damage that the statute was designed to prevent, and the defendant has no plausible excuse, then the judge may say, I hereby apply the doctrine of negligence per se in the Cardozo kind of fashion. Okay, second question here. Let's assume we've met these things, and the judge says, I agree with the plaintiff, the doctrine of negligence per se applies to this case. Then what? Where do we go from there? Mr. Berhau? Well, but I don't think he can do that. In other words, just as the plaintiff was, at least should have been, prevented in the buggy case, Martin versus Herzog, should have been prevented from going to the jury and saying, I know it looks bad, but let me tell you about this. I really wasn't negligent. What Cardozo says, in effect, is the jury has no such dispensing power. When we say it's negligence per se, that one is over. So the idea that we've only sort of created a presumption or shifted the burden of proof, and now the defendant gets their, you know, the bottom half of the inning to see what they can make of it, if you're in a Cardozo-type jurisdiction that views it as inflexible, then that particular issue is not available for the jury to rethink. But then what? Where do we go from here? Ms. Cazuela? Okay. About 50% of the time, I can get someone to say, well, then the defendant is liable, and all we're talking about then is damages. But you correctly said that what we need, in addition to establishing negligence, is causation. So just as in Martin versus Herzog, we should have, in theory, we did have an opportunity to consider the question of causation, but Cardozo no sooner brings it up than he then slams the door on the plaintiff. Ordinarily, even if the defendant is found to be negligent as a matter of law, the defendant can still say, yeah, but my negligence didn't cause the injury. Now, in some kinds of cases, that's a plausible argument. In other cases, it's pointless. So, for example, if you're driving through Spokane you're following the local custom, which is to consider a red light purely advisory, that if it was green sometime in the recent past, you can still go through the intersection. But if you're found to have violated the statute by not stopping when the light turns yellow and eventually red, and you go sailing through the intersection, someone else naively believing that a green light means that it's safe to travel into the intersection, and you smash into them, it would be pretty difficult for you to say, well, yeah, maybe I was negligent in failing to stop at the intersection, but what did that have to do with the accident? Obviously, if you had obeyed the statute, you would have stopped and the plaintiff would not have gotten hit. So in some cases, it's a lead pipe cinch. In other cases, you would say, as in Tedler versus Ellman, there was at least the argument, well, we're not so sure that this thing actually caused the accident. Tedler versus Ellman is a bad example because it's a different basis for talking about causation. But Martin versus Herzog would have, but for Cardozo's high-handedness, it would have been a case where the plaintiff could say, okay, maybe I was negligent in failing to have a light on my buggy. Maybe that's established as a matter of law. I can't try to talk my way out of that. But I still get my day in court to persuade the jury that the lack of light didn't cause the accident. Okay, question number three. What happens if negligence per se is not found? Suppose you're not able to satisfy the judge that you've met all these criteria, and the judge says, nice try, but I don't think you're entitled to a negligence per se instruction. Then what? Yeah. Mr. Feller, yeah. Right, then the plaintiff essentially has to go the long way around the barn. It's, you know, the advantage of negligence per se is that it eliminates the need to go through this laborious process, this risky process of appealing to the jury's experience or whatever other tools you're going to use to persuade them, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you ought to believe in this case the defendant is negligent. If you're entitled to negligence per se, the judge will direct that as a matter of law. That's a much better place to be. It's one item on your checklist that you can simply consider done. But that doesn't mean if you lose the argument over negligence per se, it doesn't mean you can't prove negligence. It just means you don't get the shortcut. instead of picking up that card in Monopoly that says advance directly to go, collect $200, you got to keep throwing the dice and, you know, working your way around the board. You can eventually get there. It just takes you a few more turns. So, again, negligence per se is simply one option, and even if it turns out you're unsuccessful in using it, you can always try the appeal to the jury that they find, as a matter of fact, that the defendant acted unreasonably. Correct? Well, it may be very persuasive to the jury, and in fact, skipping over note number four here to note number five, some jurisdictions, Washington happens to be one of them, have, for the most part, eliminated the doctrine of negligence per se. They simply say, we don't think juries ought to be treated sort of coercively or what have you. We don't want these statutes holding a gun to the jury's head. A statutory violation is merely persuasive evidence for the jury then to make up their own mind. Now, as it turns out, there are, I just was working on my update to my Washington tort law treatise, and there are cases in which judges have said, well, maybe the doctrine of negligence per se doesn't apply, but in this case, the statutory violation is such that no reasonable juror could reach any other conclusion except that this was negligent. So applying negligence as a matter of law, even though the doctrine of negligence per se doesn't apply. So in the same way, back in the turntable case that the judges said, you know, driving at a breakneck speed, you know, flying around the corner on a narrow road would be negligent as a matter of law, because no reasonable person could look at that and reach any other conclusion except to say that it's negligent. There are cases even in jurisdictions that that have rejected the idea of statutory violations establishing negligence per se. They've said, well, a judge hasn't lost the power to exercise this idea. Gee, on these facts, that's negligent as a matter of law. What's good in Washington from the defendant's standpoint, or from the standpoint of a person who's being challenged with a negligence per se finding, what's good is that the sort of technical violations, if you're out on I-90 and the traffic is moving at 65 to 70 miles an hour, and it's a 60-mile-an-hour zone, and you're going 62 miles an hour, under Washington law, you're not negligent per se, even though you're violating the statute. The purpose of the statute is to avoid accidents like this, and you really don't have any excuse. It's still up to the jury to decide, is traveling 62 miles an hour in a 60-mile-an-hour zone negligent or not? Yeah. If, for example, the defendant is going 80 miles an hour in a 50-mile-an-hour zone, yeah, I mean, the plaintiff, this is a little bit sort of a procedural here, but eventually we will get to this idea. Those things which are a matter of law, strict liability is often a matter of law rather than a matter of fact, but negligence per se is a matter of law, the plaintiff will try to get, or the moving party who wants the benefit of this finding as a matter of law, wants to nail those things down before trial. Trial is very expensive, and trial happens all at once. You have to be prepared when you go to trial to present the full range of testimony and the full range of issues, and it helps you if you can nail things down and know, hey, I'm pretty confident we'll meet this test or we'll be able to get to this point, but having that decided as a matter of law, so that instead of actually going through the motions and proving it and so forth, I can just consider that a done deal. I'll ask for that in a pretrial motion. So I'll file a motion for summary judgment or for partial summary judgment in which the judge makes certain findings. If the judge agrees that this is suitable for summary judgment or partial summary judgment, to say these issues are in the bag, so to speak. These are now verities for purposes of this case. There are still a bunch of disputed issues that await trial, but as to these issues, I'm going to resolve them here and now. And depending upon the temperament of the judge, some judges are more likely, as lawyers would say, to pull the trigger, and some judges are more likely to kind of keep all their options open and, you know, will decide the clearest cases, but anything that's the least bit doubtful, they'll sort of postpone, you know, hesitate to sort of look like they're being high-handed. So again, and as a lawyer, sometimes you want a judge who's, you know, easygoing and slow to pull the trigger and listens to everybody and so forth. And sometimes you want an SOB as a judge who will pull the trigger because you need to get the show on the road. So again, depending upon where you are, you either gravitate, and again, the way the judges are assigned in federal court, for example, is sort of a random process where they just pull envelopes out of a drawer and say, okay, today this judge gets this case, and in superior court it may be done at a later process. In the federal courts, the judge is assigned the day the case is filed. In the state courts, they're often the assignment of a judge is postponed until you actually get ready for trial. Anyway, there are all kinds of different ways in which judges get assigned. Sometimes one judge handles all the motions. Sometimes there's a special motion judge. Again, there are all sorts of different variations as to who your judge is, but the sort of forum shopping that lawyers do to say, gee, sometimes when you get your case assigned to this judge, you'll say, okay, we're dismissing our case. We'll take a voluntary non-suit. We're done. You know, we're going to dismiss our case and go refile it later or file it in another jurisdiction because this one, getting assigned this judge is just terrible for my client. Yeah. Every once in a while, jurors will be allowed to, jurors can come back to the judge and say, Judge, we need to see this piece of evidence, or we'd like to have you read back the testimony on this particular point. But that's fairly rare. The idea is that the instructions are supposed to be clear enough so that by rereading the instructions, the jury can understand what it is they're supposed to do. And that obviously places a huge weight on the instructions. It's also one of the reasons why courts like these pattern instructions that are sort of tried and true, as opposed to, but every once in a while you have to, make up an instruction or modify them to fit a particular case. But in doing so, you risk inadvertently leaving the jury confused. But in theory, these instructions are ones that a jury can simply listen to, and then they get them in writing, and now they know what their job is. Okay. So, again, I want to emphasize with respect to note number 5 that another sort of piece of analysis here is the jurisdictional question. Before you reach a conclusion about the application of negligence per se, you have to ask the question, assuming I would otherwise have a great case for negligence per se, am I in a jurisdiction that follows this hard-edged Cardozo approach, or am I in a jurisdiction like Washington that has, for the most part, you can see that in Washington, some areas, DUI primarily, or most significantly, has been left as an item of negligence per se, but with respect to speeding or, you know, lack of proper signaling or other kinds of traffic violations, those things don't generate a this Cardozo statutory violation negligence as a matter of law. Okay. Well, then let's look at res ipsa here in Judson. Ms. Peters, can you tell us about Judson? Okay. The respondents being, okay, the plaintiff, yeah, okay. So the plaintiffs won at the trial court level, and now the defendants are appealing, and what's the defendant's argument on appeal? Okay, and what's the plaintiff's basis for saying that we ought to presume negligence in this case? On what authority or on what principle could the plaintiff create a presumption that the defendant was negligent? That's our problem, that ordinarily we expect the plaintiff to come forward with witnesses to say, gee, I was pulling out of this intersection, the light had turned green, all of a sudden the defendant's car comes shooting, you know, through the intersection and injured me. And even if, you know, the person dies in the accident, there are other witnesses, or we have skid marks, or we have other ways of satisfying ourselves, okay, the defendant was negligent. Here, as the case puts it somewhat colorfully, none was left to tell the tale. So how do we legally shift the burden to the defendant? Okay, in particular, the label that we put on this, res ipsa loquitur. Okay, so the. This is sometimes referred to as a maxim of the law or a legal doctrine. Again, in the history of tort law in particular, tort law tends to be more kind of common law, sort of bubbling up from the just sort of the handling of cases. Some things in tort law have arisen, as we'll see, just from sort of maxims. They're sort of like, you know, reading a book of Proverbs or something like that. And this little maxim, res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself, applies to certain kinds of cases. What kinds of cases does it apply to? When does the plaintiff get to take advantage of this doctrine of res ipsa loquitur? That's sort of the intuitive quality of this idea that the thing speaks for itself. Another sort of modern translation would be duh, that in effect, once you say what happened, essentially the conclusion follows rather rapidly. But what are the characteristics? What is it about this case that leads you to make this presumption? And this has been sort of reduced to a set of sort of requirements. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. what is it that leads us, because that's the end of the process. At the end of the process, we make the conclusion they must have been negligent. But what is it that leads us to that conclusion? Mr. Breck? Okay, and this is again a sort of empirical question, that is it within our experience that people are going along, minding their own business, operating dynamite factories, doing all the things reasonable people could do, and then suddenly they blow up? No, our more typical experience is that when that happens, it's usually a result of somebody's negligence. So again, this first requirement is that the type of injury occurs, or we'll put it in the negative, does not occur in the absence of negligence. This is the way the test is traditionally formulated. It would, in many ways, be more logical, perhaps more elegant, to put it in the positive form, that this type of injury or this type of accident suggests negligence. But the way the test has been formulated, it is in this sort of double negative. These kinds of accidents don't ordinarily occur except when somebody has been negligent. Now, what else about this particular case makes it logical that we shift the presumption to the defendant to sort of say, well, we're going to assume that this resulted from negligence. Now, you, defendant, talk your way out of it if you can. What else about this case makes it fair to shift that burden to the defendant? Ms. Cuss. Okay. I'm actually going to shift this down to number three and translate it a little bit to say, in effect, other plausible explanations sufficiently, and these are sort of weasel words here. There's some room here to kind of play around with it. Just as in the first requirement, we say accidents like this don't ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence. We say that other causes, including the plaintiff's negligence or third parties, but other causes have been sufficiently eliminated. We're not saying we know this to a moral certainty, but, for example, on the day that this dynamite factory blew up, there was no terrorist raid. We didn't see, a 757 circling around the dynamite factory and then disappears and it all of a sudden blows up. We've kind of been through it and we can't find any other plausible explanation. But there's the middle element here. Okay. Okay, and the word exclusive is sometimes omitted or modified or whatever, but I'll leave it in because, and the reason it's a little bit troublesome, the word exclusive, is because it means exclusive for this purpose. That is, for example, and the way the end of this sentence goes is, again, a sort of term or a form of art. The term that's often used is the instrumentality of the accident. And that's kind of this abstract word. But in other words, whatever it is that caused this accident was in the control of the defendant. Therefore, if somebody was negligent, it's fair to attribute that to the defendant. That's the reason why we care about this. If a bunch of different people had control of this, even if we were convinced it was a result of negligence, it wouldn't be fair to put the burden on the defendant if the defendant didn't have such control of it that we can say it's your fault that this thing blew up or what have you. Now, maybe it's 10 years ago, I can't remember exactly how long ago it was, that the plane took off, it's on a hot summer day, takes off from JFK, I think it was TWA flight 800, something like that. Anyway, it takes off from JFK, and it's climbing, and all of a sudden it bursts and, you know, explodes, basically, and falls into Long Island Sound, and everybody's killed, and they've got wreckage. And in the beginning, you know, there were some reports that maybe the Army had been firing test missiles or, you know, that maybe there was terrorism. Nobody really knew in the beginning. Eventually, I think the conclusion about Flight 800 was that there was an empty, nearly empty center fuel tank that on a hot summer day, the air conditioning system went right past this thing, and there was something about the mechanism within the center fuel tank that caused a spark. This spark ignited this vapor within the center fuel tank, and that's what brought the whole plane down. Now, we don't know that to a moral certainty, but again, I'm trying to illustrate this idea of exclusive control. If you want to blame Boeing because the plane blew up and say your design of this plane in which the air conditioning system went past the center fuel tank, but you don't really know that. All you know is plane takes off, plane blows up. You could say, as to Boeing, planes don't ordinarily blow up in the middle of flight, except where there's some kind of negligence, some bad design, some, you know, bad maintenance, etc. But the question is, does Boeing have exclusive control? They don't have, obviously, Boeing makes the plane, sells it to, I think it was TWA that was operating the flight. When TWA takes the plane, Boeing no longer controls it in one sense, but Boeing, anyway. The point I'm making is, you may say, to the extent we've identified the problem here as one involving structural integrity, it wasn't because somebody dropped a wrench, you know, on an electrical contact, or, you know, that somebody, you know, packed what were those oxygen things that were packed in a plane that crashed in Florida. Remember, it caught fire in Florida and then went into the swamp. The Value Jet, I think it was, that, again, about 10 or 15 years ago. Those kinds of plane crashes where, yeah, that was caused by somebody who allowed these oxygen canisters to be transported, and they caught on fire, and that's what caused the plane to go down. Again, to the extent you've identified what the problem is, and you say the defendant had control over that aspect of it, you may meet this exclusive control test, even though the defendant doesn't have exclusive control over the whole thing. A little bit technical. And again, the final one that we already talked about, we can infer negligence from this kind of accident, and the word I want to emphasize here is type of accident. I can't tell you how many times in grading exams I've had students misstate the rule as though it were the but-for cause test. So that what they say is, well, if this guy hadn't been negligent, the accident would not have occurred. That's a fine statement of the proximate cause test, chapter 2. But that's different from saying this is the type of accident which ordinarily doesn't occur except where there's negligence. So again, the inference runs like this. Accidents like this don't usually happen where there's no negligence. The person in charge of it was the defendant. We've looked through other potential explanations and none of them seem to fit. Ergo, therefore, the defendant was probably negligent here. It's an educated guess. Ms. Schmidt? jackscrew. Right. 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 Well, it's interesting that you raised that, because one of the cases that I mentioned in the notes here is on page 34, note number 3, this case Ibarra versus Spangard. It's precisely a multiple defendant case in which the plaintiff says, gee, I don't know which of you caused my harm, but I know somebody was negligent here, and you guys sorted out which of you caused my harm. Now, ordinarily, that's really well short of the burden of proof on the plaintiff to get a res ipsa instruction. And my reason for thinking that the court allowed it in Ibarra versus Spangard is that, although technically in a healthcare situation, hospital and physician are not all on the same team, they are legally distinct entities. The hospital has its own, you know, rules and procedures and insurance and so forth. The doctor is an independent contractor that has privileges at the hospital, but typically waltzes in, does the surgery, and then leaves. For purposes of what happens in the operating room, the court says it's as though they're all one big happy family here. But it shouldn't lead you to be casual about thinking, as long as I know that somebody was negligent, I can name a whole pile of people and say, hey, you guys sort it out. So if, for example, I walk out in the morning and discover that my car parked out on the street has been sideswiped, there's a bunch of blue paint on the car, I can't simply file a complaint against all the people with blue cars in the neighborhood and say, well, one of you guys sideswiped my car, you sort it out. I have to be able to essentially cite some close working relationship, such as there is between the physician and the hospital in Ibarra versus Spangard, or perhaps in this airline case in which the manufacturer of the plane, whose employees are frequently, you know, interacting, their engineers are frequently going to the airlines and helping them, you know, with technical service bulletins and training them, et cetera, they work very closely together. Maybe that's like Ibarra versus Spangard. The other thing about the Alaska Airlines case is, which is another important point to raise, is essentially because something is missing, and that's why I start with Judson versus Giant Powder. You know, none was left to tell the tale. It's the most dramatic example of a case in which we're missing the kinds of evidence we would ordinarily look to for the plaintiff to establish negligence. In these airline crash cases, through the remarkable efforts of, you know, the black boxes and the reconstruction of the plane and all these kinds of radar and cockpit voice recorders and all these things, we can often determine with reasonable satisfaction what actually caused this particular crash. So, again, it is the best use for res ipsa loquitur is we don't have the kind of evidence we do in a lot of these airplane crash cases to say with some, okay, you know, the explosion radiated out from this particular point. We can see that it began here and went over there, or we can tell that this, you know, the tearing of the horizontal stabilizer, whatever it is, that's what caused the plane, and then we can trace the flight pattern. Yeah, we know that it was the failure of this jack screw that caused it, and then you're into an area in which you don't really need res ipsa anymore. res ipsa is most useful and most appropriate where you're still not dealing from anything close to a full deck. You're still guessing about what probably happened rather than being able to say, well, you know, with reasonable engineering confidence, I believe this is what caused this accident. Ms. Ma? Well, I mean, for example, in looking at airplane crashes, we can say that most of the time, airplanes take off and land safely with no mishap. It's 99.9% of the time that happens. And in that small percentage of cases where something bad happens, in the vast majority of those cases, we have pretty clear evidence of what did happen. But in the remaining cases where, for whatever reason, we can't tell what happened, we could revert to the res ipsa doctrine to say, from our experience, most of the time when a plane crashes, it is due to pilot error, to defect in the manufacturer, and so forth. Obviously, you would have some difficulty if you're completely ignorant of being able to establish that the defendant had exclusive control, but maybe you would get away with throwing these defendants into a single hopper and say, here's the manufacturer of the plane, here's the airline that operated the plane. I don't know whether it was the pilot that messed up or it was bad equipment. You guys sort it out. I, the injured passenger, or the, executor of the estate of the deceased passenger, I should be able to simply throw that burden over to you. Now, in the next case, in Murphy, we take up the an application of this in a more modern case, obviously, in which the plaintiff's trying to get the benefit of this inference in order to avoid being required to put their finger on what it is the defendant did that was negligent. Mr. Reich? Correct. And that's a very important distinction between res ipsa and negligence per se, for example, or res ipsa and strict liability that we'll come to later, that res ipsa loquitur simply says we think there was negligence, but defendant, we're very interested in listening to what you have to say. Remember, in response to Mr. Berhau's, answer to one of the initial questions, what happens if you establish the elements of negligence per se? It is the case in res ipsa that you now shift the burden to the defendant and, okay, defendant, what do you have to say for yourself? But remember, in negligence per se, there is no such, bottom half of the inning. It's over. Because as a matter of law, we've reached that conclusion. So again, negligence per se and res ipsa operate or have different effects. One leaves the question of negligence open. The other one essentially closes the book. Now, again, in a res ipsa case, if in fact we're missing the evidence upon which you can tell what caused this accident, if the plaintiff gets the benefit of res ipsa and the judge looks at the facts and says, I think the plaintiff's met all three of these requirements, I'm going to instruct the jury that they may infer negligence from just the happening of the accident. If, in fact, we don't know what happens, it puts the defendant in a pretty tough position. How do they overcome the presumption when we don't really know what happened? Now, the defendant may want to tell you all of the wonderful things they do, how many safety awards they've won, and how scrupulously they inspect, and et cetera, and try to persuade the jury, I know you're thinking we were negligent, but But look at the evidence, ladies and gentlemen, not in this particular case. Look at what a great job we did. How could you find in this case we were negligent? And maybe that will carry the day. But the plaintiff hopes that in the back of their mind they're saying, yeah, but then if you guys did such a, you know, if you're so smart, why ain't you rich? You know, if you did such a great job, how come your plane crashed, or how come your elevator didn't wind up in the right place? Ms. Johnson? But again, we don't know the specific thing they did wrong. That's the thing about res ipsa. The dynamite factory goes up in a mushroom cloud, and there's nobody around to figure out, well, did somebody, you know, somebody with a forklift, you know, made a too quick a turn, or somebody carrying a Bunsen burner, you know, dropped it, or what is it? We don't really know. What all we can figure out is somebody screwed up. Because after all, if they were doing everything they were supposed to do, we wouldn't have seen that big mushroom cloud. So unlike the industry custom thing where we can identify, gee, you didn't have a radio, or you didn't do this, or you should have done that, in a res ipsa case, we're simply assuming there was something out there that somebody did, and therefore the defendant has a much harder time coming back and saying, but we were okay to do this. It's again, a lot of guesswork. Okay, well, we'll pick up with Murphy on Monday.